It's so deep.
Yeah.
This relationship and this bond between Ahlul Bayt and their followers is something beyond description.
Very true.
And it cannot be contained in just words and things like that. So I guess this was all the time that we had for today's episode. Still, I guess we have something more to talk about, but inshallah we'll cover them in the coming episodes. Thank you, dear listeners. Thank you for staying with us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? Please, oh please, please come.
Midstream.
International mobilization to cover the Zionist enemies' crimes in the Gaza Strip does not seem to be sufficient to provide guarantees of the success of any ground campaign against the Strip amid fears of reactions that might go beyond how the Palestinian resistance in Gaza will retaliate to what the forces of the Axis of Resistance can do from outside Palestine. Over the past week, preparations by the Axis of Resistance to provide regional support to the resistance in Palestine have been underway as joint operations rooms was formed with a large set of plans that reflected the performance of a group of Axis factions in more than one arena across West Asia. Over the past 4 days, the Axis powers have been translating this into practical steps. A series of coordinated military operations were carried out across several arenas. For instance, the Al-Qassam Brigades launched a missile strike from Lebanon towards the northern Israeli occupation colonies, while the Al-Quds Brigades were detonating explosive devices in Tul Karm, killing and wounding the enemy squads. Meanwhile, Hezbollah continued its operations aimed at blinding the occupation army along the border with Lebanon. The Hezbollah resistance strikes on occupation military sites have so far destroyed advanced surveillance cameras that allow coverage areas with a range of 20 kilometers. Radars installed on towers at the sites have also been destroyed, in addition to a system of eavesdropping on communications and jamming. Simultaneously, a group of Iraqi resistance factions initiated successive drone strikes against U.S. occupation bases in Iraq and Syria, causing direct casualties there, before the United States announced that its naval vessels had intercepted missiles launched by the Yemeni Ansarullah, supposedly were targeting the Zionist occupation territories when USS Kearney intercepted the missile's path. The Islamic resistance in Iraq also targeted with missiles and drones the El Tanf occupation base on the border triangle between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, and Conoco gas field base in Deir ez-Zor, before this was followed by the explosion of the gas pipeline connecting to the last base itself. The same resistance announced a drone attack on the Ain al-Asad occupation base in the Anbar province 2 days after the same base was subjected to a similar attack by drones, coinciding with another attack on the Harir occupation base in the northern Iraq. These targets came after the threat made by the Iraqi resistance that all U.S. bases in Syria and Iraq have become a legitimate target for them, until the Israeli bombing of the people of the Gaza Strip stops. This new strategy demonstrated through these lightning attacks that the Axis of Resistance has the ability to bypass U.S. fortifications and harm the occupation bases all across West Asia. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. All the forces forces of the resistance axis across the Arab and Islamic countries have established in the past few days a working mechanism related to providing the highest level of effective support to the resistance in Palestine. A group of joint operation rooms was formed that monitors field conditions in terms of daily and strategic actions, in addition to political activity. A large set of plans also crystallized, creating a positive climate that was reflected in the performance of a group of Axis factions in more than one arena. To discuss this new development with us from Madrid is Chema Sanchez, leader of the anti-imperialistas.com group, member of RED, which is Network for the Defense for Humanity, and also self-proclaimed anti-imperialist militant. Thanks a lot for being with us, Chema. It's an honor to have you on with us. Now, as soon as U.S. President Joe Biden finished his urgent visit to Tel Aviv in the occupied Palestinian territories, declaring his embrace of the entity and absolute support for it in the war of extermination against the people of Palestine, numerous explosions rang all around where U.S. occupation bases reside, especially in Syria, in Iraq, whether it's in Al-Tanf in Iraq, on the border between Iraq, Syria, and Jordan, or the Conoco field, gas field in the countryside of Deir ez-Zor in Syria, also Ain al-Assad base, which is in Anbar province in Iraq, was targeted. What does these messages by the Axis of Resistance mean for the United States of America's presence right here in West Asia?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to your show, Marwa, because you are working with seeking the truth, not us in the Western media. Well, I believe that this is a clear warning from the resistance that they are not going to be intimidated, that they are not afraid of them, and that they are not going to surrender and retreat. This is a warning that the initiative of the final and definitive struggle that was born with the operation on October 7 on the Palestinian resistance united will continue, that it will no longer be possible to remain immune and unpunished with the U.S. imperialist bases in the region. The so-called unprovoked invasion, you know, as unprovoked attack of the Palestinian resistance, well, they are liars. But this, the U.S. will no longer be able to continue in the area without consequences for its troops or those of its lackeys. The Arab League and the usual lies of the U.S. are no longer unconditional. The economic strengths of the U.S. are no longer where they were, and the global economic crisis of the empire and its Western front is already of such magnitude that the empire is running forward towards the solution of the war, the business war as a solution, and that may lead it to precipitate the empire fall and with more damage than would be the case under the acceptance of its surrender in end.
Well, Chema, during the very first days of the confrontation, we saw that the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, right here in Lebanon, carrying out a military deployment in the southern border with occupied Palestine, where some sort of skirmishes began with the Zionist entity, which now are developed on a daily basis. Now, according to the enemy's own admission, the resistance was able to destroy 10 Merkava tanks so far, and a group of military vehicles, and has wounded at least 60 soldiers between dead or wounded. At the same time, the resistance provided a group of martyrs. They presented more than 24 martyrs so far in the battlefield, and the enemy bombed resistance sites in the towns of southern Lebanon. What do you think will happen in case an open war opens between the Lebanese side and the occupied Palestinian side?
Well, an inflection point. Well, the heroic resistance of Palestine pushed towards its final battle against the occupying Zionist entity. This is a resistance with many strengths, but when you are talking about Hezbollah, the organized resistance and military power of Hezbollah is even much more than so. And Lebanon knows that they are the next to be attacked, and Hezbollah, as brothers of destiny and fighting alongside their sister nation, Palestine, is already showing that this battle is also their battle. And if Israel advances in its genocide, it's clear that Lebanon will not be able to sit back and waiting without preparing for war, and needs, in fact, to show its teeth at the border since Israel is already accumulating its military forces there as well. As a tool of the Yankee Empire as they are, the Zionists are approaching all weapons, political pressure, American support, even nuclear threat. Mm-hmm. But in this regard, about the nuclear threat, the Russia and China are already beginning to warn of escalation, and they evidently know which side they should be in that case. Putin already said that his missiles are already in the air on his planes in the Black Sea, just in case, he said, mm-hmm. since the Empire had taken the Yankee fleet to the Mediterranean mm-hmm. Sea.
Well, it is very interesting how things are really developing, how bigger states are getting involved as the days go by. But what was very interesting, Chema, was what Yemen was able to do. I mean, Yemen rose above its wounds, and it sent several missiles that the Zionists and the U.S. Disagreed, basically, on the determining whether the destination was actually the Israeli entity or not. But nonetheless, we did see that the battleship USS Kearney stopping those missiles, intercepting those missiles that were supposedly going to southern occupied Palestinian cities, like, for example, Eilat. Regardless of the destination of the missiles here, how important is the launching of Yemeni missiles while the U.S. is actually covering the Red Sea to protect the Israeli entity?
Well, you are talking about countries like Yemen or Syria, even that countries that have suffered so many years from the imperialist onslaught, and that maybe at a minimum in strength, they feel part of that world threatened by the terror of the collective West. And this is very important, that they are not going to sit and wait for the final destiny to be eliminated one by one, but this war for them means that it's a war already being declared on the entire region for those that does not submit, and that doesn't remain silent in the face of this massacre of our people of Palestine. The truth is that for those who don't believe in victory, I will say that till now they have made us, by media, by culture, have made us to believe that the empire is invincible and we must always negotiate in defeat. But since Russia's response in Ukraine, since the waning of many countries in Africa, since the unity of Russia and China, since October 7, and the heroic action begun by the Palestinian resistance, we must all know that victory has already doesn't wait to look for an exit through the window as a solution of this confinement. And we are going to lead through the door. The solution and the victory are waiting by crossing this door with dignity, this exit door that is finally and frontally confronting that empire, the European Zionist Yankee Empire, whose crucial bulwark in the region is Israel's entity in occupied Palestine. We are winning. They know that we are winning. They know that because the media lies are falling and the numerous rallies all around the world are unstoppable. And this is something must help us to uncover the real methods of terror and lies, the empire war against humanity. Yes, mm-hmm. The victory is here. The victory is there for us, and we must go on.
We will go on. I want to thank you immensely, Chema Sanchez, leader of the anti-imperialistas.com group, member of Red Network for the Defense of Humanity, and also anti-imperialist militant. Thanks a million for your contribution to our show. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about how the Israeli entity chose massacre over any sane solution.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Since October 7 and over the course of 10 days, Benjamin Netanyahu had searched for any kind of military action to direct it against the Palestinians, which would actually give some relief for the extreme Zionist settlers. The first option was a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip from the north. But because of the difficulty of the mission, the occupation resorted to the massacre option, which was bombing the Baptist hospital using the Israeli Air Force. How did that happen? More details in the following report.
Since October 7, and over the course of 10 days, Benjamin Netanyahu has searched for military action directed against the Palestinian natives in Gaza, through which he would appease the extremist Zionist blocs. The first option was a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip from its north, but because of the difficulty of the mission, the occupation resorted to the massacre option, which was to bomb Al Ahli Baptist Hospital using the Israeli Air Force. The U.S.-made missile, which was launched from an U.S. warjet piloted by an Israeli entity pilot, hit the courtyard of the hospital affiliated with the Anglican Episcopal Church in Al-Quds, which contained large numbers of wounded and displaced civilians. Hundreds were martyred and wounded, the majority of whom were women and children. Here, the massacre, the extermination, the insane violence occurred, and the ground was colored with Palestinian blood. The Arabs, Muslims, and free peoples of the world cried over the images of the martyred children. But the same event on the other side and inside the occupied territories was a day of revenge for the Zionist extremists, who have not rested their minds since the victory achieved by the resistance during the Al-Aqsa flood operation. The Zionist media itself admits that the Israeli entity, so-called society, was thirsty for revenge in an insane and unprecedented way, and the military media machine was counting the number of deaths in Gaza, drawing a comparison between the Zionist Iron Swords operation and the Al-Aqsa flood, and that the colonial settlers were eager to hear news that narrated their thirst for blood, or in other words, the Hebrew definition of victory. Here, the occupation army's confession of bombing the hospital is equal to its denial, because the Israeli entity, in its innate racism and bloodiness, drank from the blood of women and children that was spilled in the El Zaytun neighborhood, and that was enough, just as the settlers slept soundly on the night of the 17th of October, after millions of Arabs and Muslims saw it, after their faces turned black and tears flowed from their eyes, after they lived the days of Al-Aqsa flood euphoria of victory. The immediate crisis at the moment is that the media that supports the Palestinian cause has often been involved in serving the Zionist policy by focusing on the brutality and criminality of the enemy without mentioning the ability of the resistance to refine the beast, trim its nails, and subjugate it. Thus, a number of myths have become entrenched among the Arabs and Muslims regarding the exceptional capabilities of the occupation, while one experience after the other confirms that Zionist Israel is nothing but a fragile entity, internally torn apart, ideologically empty and easy to defeat, all evident by the resistance missiles that are still being launched from Gaza towards the occupied territories with high precision.
Discuss this issue with us from Athens is Ms. Lamprini Thoma, who's a journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thanks a million for being with us, Ms. Lamprini. Now, I was following your work in covering the Al Ahli Baptist Hospital massacre, and I noticed that thousands of Greek civilians protested. They took to the street to support Gaza and Palestine and to condemn the Zionist Israeli genocide against Palestinians. But I saw it on your feed, not on European mainstream media. Tell us more about the solidarity movement back home in Greece in specific, and maybe in Europe in general. And why are we seeing this crackdown in Europe against the Palestinian narrative and those who support it?
There's censorship. First of all, it's an honor, always an honor to be with you.
My pleasure.
There's censorship not only on the Palestinian issue. There's a lot of subjects that our government and the whole of the self-righteous West have decided and imposed, especially in Greece, which behaves like a U.S. client state and says yes to everything they ask of it. The problem is even bigger. This is also a problem for domestic reporting on various issues, so much so that in the last 10 years, Greece has fallen 100 positions almost in some international press freedom rankings. Mm-hmm. But it's intensified for contentious current think topics like this. In any case, even if our government doesn't, I'd say that the majority of common folk in Greece supports the Palestinians full-heartedly. It is a relationship that goes decades back. Older people like me know it, and I have to remind our younger audience that it was Greece who sheltered Yasser Arafat when he left Beirut, with Greek people taking the streets in every city and village at the time to support the Palestinian struggle for freedom. Videos like of that of Spanish member of the European Parliament, Manuel Pineda, Manu Pineda, as they call him, who was forced to take off his kafilla so he would be allowed to speak at the European Parliament, are indicative of the pressure free speech voices are facing right now. Yeah, that was unbelievable. Still, they may try to control the narrative and follow the US example at the top, but they very well know that it's not the case at the base.
But Lamprini, the Zionist media itself, it admitted that the Israeli entity, so-called settler society, was thirsty for revenge. In an insane and unprecedented way, they were eagerly counting the number of dead babies in Gaza so they could be happy. This is untainted evidence that the Israeli entity actually committed the massacre of the Baptist hospital, yet they are now denying it in all of the media. How do you perceive this thirst for Palestinian blood and death in the colonial Israeli entity settler community? I mean, what do they want?
First of all, it was them. Nobody with his mind in the right place, not the heart, the mind in the right place, wouldn't see that. Second, the change in the Israeli society and politics has been obvious for years now. They're moving to the far right. They're moving to the far right. Along with murderous supremacists, they have taken the upper hand, especially with this government. This is, I don't know, there's no words for those people. I'm old enough to remember the 1993 pro-peace and pro-Palestinian state demonstrations in Tel Aviv with thousands of socialists at the time participants. That has not been the case for some time now. May never be the case again. Those that govern Israel today are the ideological and political descendants of those who murdered their own prime minister, Yitzhak Rabin, to stop the peace process. And Yitzhak Rabin was not the nicest person you will meet in the world. But he saw that we needed realpolitik to solve this problem and to stop murdering people, because they were still murdering people then. But never mind the pro-Palestinian Israeli left, even the moderate voices in Israel are under attack. It's censorship, it's the narrative. As you know, Ofer Kassif, member of the Knesset and Jewish himself, but a very decent man, was suspended from the Israeli parliament for 45 days because he condemned the bombing of Gaza.
Yeah.
And they're not going to pay him for 2 months, I think, or something. So this suppression in what Biden describes as a democratic state is affected on the policies towards their own who dare to disagree too.
Well, that doesn't really surprise me there, but U.S. interests have become greatly threatened in the region of West Asia due to their exquisite bias towards the Israeli occupation. I mean, the resistance factions in Iraq, for example, they did not hesitate to launch airstrikes or to launch strikes with drones at the Ain al-Assad base, for example, in the west of the country. They also targeted Syria and Deir ez-Zor, the Conoco gas field. They even, some anonymous groups, they lighted up the gas field. We are seeing angry Arab protesters all across the Arab world marching towards the U.S. embassy, protesting against this brutality. Is this really the last U.S. chapter of its illegal presence in West Asia? Or if so, if it is the last chapter, what is the future of the United States of America in West Asia?
The Western influence in lots of places has been on the wane for some time now. Especially after the war in Ukraine, it started accelerating, or at least the unilateral imposition of its will is destroyed day by day by day. We have entered another era. one in which the global south is rising and demands to be heard. And it is obvious that the US are having their Suez moment, as the geopolitical analysts used to say. We are watching the end of the unipolar world, the unipolar Western rule, the end of the reign of neocolonialism, really. Mm-hmm. It is the end of an era built on theft, established on the blood of millions of people, sustained mostly by momentum at the moment, I believe, like, you know, those cartoon characters who get to obliviously walk off a cliff and for a few moments they don't realize they're on the air. Mm-hmm. They're like that right now.
Well, that doesn't really surprise me, but in the end, we still have 1 minute or less, Lamprini, and I want to hear your take on the calamity and the grief and the pain of Gaza. What do you think we can do about it, you and I?
Talk. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid of the people who try to shut us up. Continue to talk. There's a reign of terror over journalists here in Europe. Mm-hmm. There's fear. They fear for their jobs, they fear for their life. I have messages from colleagues writing to me about the conditions in their job. So what we have to do as journalists is continue to say the truth, talk, tell what the truth is. And the truth is that Palestine shall be free.
It indeed shall be free, and I cannot wait for the day, Lamprini, when you come to me right here in Beirut and we drive down together to Al-Quds, inshallah, and then Gaza. I'm waiting for you. Thanks a million. With us from Athens, Ms. Lamprini Thoma, journalist at the Press Project and MC at Radio Venceremos. Thanks a million for your time and your contribution and your voice. Ladies and gents.
All our love to the Gaza and West Bank brothers and sisters.
Inshallah, definitely. Ladies and gents, I want to thank you a million also for your time. I'll see you again next week on the Middle East Stream.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. A survey by the homelessness charity Shelter found that 40% of people in rented homes had experienced poor health as a result of their living conditions in the last year, amounting to almost 3 million people in England. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. According to a study, the social fabric of United Kingdom's biggest cities is being transformed by sky-high rents and cuts to housing benefits as thousands of low-income private renters are pushed out of central areas, accelerating the suburbanization of poverty. The new study found the trend, driven also by the gentrification of once largely working-class neighborhoods and the sell-off of social homes, is excluding poorer people from inner cities and deepening divisions between rich and poor. It says low-income private renters, who a decade ago might have lived in city centres, are increasingly being displaced to a shrinking pool of affordable homes under urban periphery and beyond, often with poorer access to public transport, jobs and public services. The new study by the University of Glasgow found 1 in 9 private renters in the UK's 10 biggest cities were displaced from central locations to cheaper housing areas in the suburban fringes during the eight-year period to 2020. For example, in Bristol, the number of low-income households living in privately rented homes in the inner city fell by 38% during the period. Glasgow saw a reduction of just over 20%, while London, Sheffield and Liverpool also reductions of more than 10%. The findings illustrate political and economic policy shifts over the past two decades that are changing traditional perceptions of inner-city areas as the main locus of poverty and deprivation, and the suburbs as exclusively more affluent places. The phenomena, known in academic circles as the suburbanization of poverty, is especially visible in countries such as Britain, Canada, and the United States, where private rented housing has been deregulated and social security has been whittled away. Professor Nick Bailey, a co-author of the new study, said, "Continuing cuts in housing benefit levels, combined with the rising costs of inner-city renting, are engineering a fundamental change in the social fabric of British cities." Professor Nick Bailey added, "We need to examine the impacts this has on the welfare of poorer households as they are pushed to locations which tend to have worse public transport and worse access to jobs and vital services. But we also need to be asking whether this is the kind of city that we wish to create, one marked by deepening spatial divisions between rich and poor." The phenomena in part reflects the growing privately rented housing in the United Kingdom over the past three decades. While 1 in 10 households lived in this tenure in 1991, it now houses 1 in 5 households, including many families. More than 1 in 3 children in poverty live in privately rented homes. According to the new study by Glasgow University, a decade ago, roughly 20% of UK privately rented homes were affordable for households in receipt of housing benefit. This fell to 9% by 2020. Housing benefit rates have been frozen since then, making inner cities where private rents have risen fastest even less accessible to poorer people. Joseph Elliott of the Joseph Rantry Foundation, a poverty charity, said, "It's clear that in large cities in particular, the diminished role of the state in providing social housing and cuts to support through housing benefit have resulted in people in poverty being priced out of areas with access to the amenities that we all need, such as easy access to work, shops and transport." Paul Sweeney, the Director of Policy and Research at the Centre for Cities think tank, said policymakers must consider the potential economic impact of the displacement of increasing numbers of low-income workers away from the city centre jobs in sectors such as hospitality and public services. A British government spokesperson claimed, "We're helping to ease the pressure of rising rents and investing over £30 billion on housing support this year, on top of record financial support worth around £3,300 per household. We've also maintained our £1 billion boost to local housing allowance, while our discretionary housing payments provide a safety net for anyone struggling." Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Research suggested millions of British people living in damp and run-down properties are suffering worsening mental and physical health due to delays passing crucial reforms into law. A survey by the homelessness charity Shelter found about 40% of people in rented homes had experienced poor health as a result of their living conditions in the last year, amounting to almost 3 million people in England. Nearly two-thirds of renters in large swathes of the country, about 4.4 million people, said their mental health had worsened due to the housing worries since 2022. Campaigners are growing increasingly concerned that legal protections for renters, which are passing through Parliament, are being delayed due to opposition from Conservative MPs, of whom 1 in 5 are landlords. Osama Buta, director of campaigns at Shelter, said it is disgraceful that England's 11 million private tenants are at the mercy of a broken rental system while politicians sit on their hands and dither over whether to make renting fairer and safer. One of the main protections in the renters' bill is a ban on so-called no-fault evictions, known as Section 21 orders, whereby landlords can remove tenants without having to give a reason. Campaigners say Section 21 orders are one of the biggest causes of homelessness and are used by unscrupulous landlords to punish tenants who request basic repairs. The Conservatives first promised to ban Section 21 evictions in April of 2019, but did not introduce legislation until May of 2023. The bill had been expected to have a second reading in the House of Commons in the spring, but this is not expected to happen until November, amid reports of growing opposition to the reforms among Tory MPs. While the changes appear deadlocked in Westminster, official figures show that court proceedings for no-fault evictions have reached their highest level in the past 6 years. Research suggests someone is handed a no-fault eviction every 3 minutes, the equivalent of 543 a day, and almost 595,000 since 2020. A survey of more than 4,000 people in private rented accommodation in England suggests that delays to the changes were causing increasing ill health among those who fear eviction. According to the YouGov research on behalf of Shelter, more than 700,000 renters in London, almost 40% of the total, are suffering mental or physical problems due to worry of being evicted. People with disabilities are affected disproportionately by deteriorating health, with half of all disabled renters saying they had become more ill due to worrying about their living conditions, compared with 29% in the rest of the renting population.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker in the program, Islamic Laws. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of prayer based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, you know, Sheikh Javed, I asked you a question regarding the congregational prayer before. Let me ask you about the necessary qualifications of a prayer, leader, in short.
Well, just as I mentioned in the previous episode, I did say that, okay, there are certain requirements, certain qualities which the prayer leader must fulfill. And these are, for example, one of them is... The prayer leader should be, for example, Shia. He should be sane. He should be male. He should be adult. I mean, he should have attained the age of puberty. And the most important quality is, of course, is justice. He must be just. Mm-hmm. And of course, there is a lot of confusion about justice.
Yes, this is where you know, I would like to ask you about justice. What does it mean actually to be just, and what justice or probity mean with respect to the prayer leader, and how can the individuals, the duty bound, make sure that given a prayer leader or an individual who's about to perform or to lead the prayer is just?
Well, there is a lot of discussion going on about justice, about adala, which is a very important concept in Shia teachings. When it comes to a prayer leader, he is supposed to be just. But justice has been defined very strictly by some scholars. It's kind of a secondary habit that makes a person, stay away from haram things and perform their religious obligations without, for example, without even thinking, without even planning for it, because it's part of his habit. This is what justice means. But, you know, this is very difficult to prove that such a habit has been established in a person, or for example, it's very difficult to prove that the person, a given individual, as you rightly mentioned, has this quality embedded in him. That's not difficult. So that's why the religious authorities, the Maraje, have said that if a person's appearance suggests that he is just, for example, he has the beard, and his conduct, his normative conduct, quite clearly suggests that he is, for example, a qualified person. Now, in addition to that, if there are mu'mineen standing behind him, praying, all of these are indications, and these are proofs suggesting that he is a prayer leader. So it's not very much necessary. It's not necessary to be very much particular or obsessive about prayer leader. So you can just, if you do not know anything bad about the person, you can trust him as a just person and follow him for during prayers.
So if we are new to an area,
yes,
where we are about to, in fact, offer a prayer in the mosque, and we know nothing about the prayer leader, should we go about research and see if the person is just, and then we pray behind his back? You know.
Well, the religious authorities have said that if you see mu'mineen, okay, who are also very know the ahkam, of course, they know what justice means, and they know that one of the conditions and requirements that that a prayer leader must fulfill is justice or probity.
Okay.
And if these people follow him, stand behind him, you know, they do iqtida behind him, of course, then it's not necessary to, you know, to conduct research about him, and you know, but that sometimes you end up finding no result, getting to nowhere, because it's very difficult to establish someone's
so
justice.
So we have to give it the benefit of the doubt, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islam Gloss on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islam Gloss on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of prayer based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, you know, sometimes we can't find like religious scholars who are leading the prayers in the mosque or in some special places like chapel where, you know, congregational prayer is held normally, right?
Yes.
And sometimes, like in the schools, for example, they ask a teacher, for example, to lead the prayer for them. So the question is it permissible to, to perform the congregational prayer behind this individual who has not been to any religious school? I mean, literally.
Yes.
All right? Or Hausa, for example. It's just a layman, a practicing Muslim, right?
Yes.
And a pious person. Is it okay? Is it permissible to, stand behind him?
Well, nowhere in the Islamic scripture is it mentioned that the prayer leader should have studied in the Islamic seminaries or should have gone to a religious school. It's not a condition, and of course we come to the conclusion that it is quite permissible to follow someone who is who meets the conditions, like he is just, he is Shia Isna'ashari, he is Baligh, he is adult, and he has attained the age of puberty, and of course he is sane, and so on and so forth. These are some of the conditions, as I said. So it doesn't make any difference if he's a layman, but his qira'at is good, his recitation of the words and verses of the Quran is perfect. Why not follow him? You know, why not? You know, he's quite eligible and qualified for the leadership of the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we compare these a person who is studying the Hausa and someone, a layman, the scholar, a learned scholar, a knowledgeable scholar, and a pious scholar, is superior to someone who is not studied in the Hausa, and he is preferred over a layman.
Mm-hmm.
Just as, for example, someone who lives in a city is preferred over someone who comes from a village.
Mm-hmm. Shachavit, if a prayer leader engages in backbiting or engages in a kind of sin, can we perform prayers behind him?
Yeah. Backbiting is a major sin. It's, according to some scholars, according to some traditions, it's one of the gunahan kabira. It's a great sin.
Yeah.
So, of course, you cannot follow a prayer leader who is engaging or who engages sometimes in such an evil sin,
mm-hmm.
which is backbiting, and which is equal to, which amounts sometimes, of course, according to ayat, to the ayah of the Quran, to eating the flesh of one's own brother.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you, my dear listeners, for joining us on the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. From me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and the rest of the crew here, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Malajan Ilaha Illahum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basir
is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines, day 21 of the Israeli war on Gaza. Some 7,300 Palestinians have lost their lives, many of them women and children. The United Nations is warning that Israel's total blockade of the Gaza Strip could even claim more lives. And four Palestinians are also killed in the Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank, taking the death toll to 110.